Surah 47 from Medina. Verse 3. Those who believe and perform righteous deeds and believe what has been sent down, that's always the way it's described, sent down from God through Gabriel to Muhammad. And it is the truth from their Lord God. He has absolved them from their evil deeds and set their state aright. A comment. Those who believe in God and in the revelation given through Muhammad and perform righteous deeds have their sins forgiven. We Christians have a similar belief in God. We Christians have a similar belief. When a person genuinely converts to Christianity and is welcomed into the community in baptism, all his or her previous sins are absolved. There's no place for the sacrament of reconciliation. Baptism forgives all previous sin. We are, in Paul's words, justified by faith. Or, as he says elsewhere, we're justified by God's grace as a gift. So long as we remember that faith is not something we do, it's something we receive. This is one of the unfortunate debates that went on in the time of the Reformation, and I think theologians of every side would now see that the words, they were just passing each other in the night. They weren't actually meeting. The church, the Catholic Church, seemed to be saying you have to earn salvation through good deeds. Now, that was never the teaching, but in the common way people behaved, that was a pretty common way of looking at things. Good deeds would earn you salvation. That's not true, but it sounded like that to the reformers. On the contrary, the reformers said, no, don't do that. It's not good works that you're to do. What you're to do is believe. And they quote Paul frequently. Believing is what you get to do, and that's believing that brings salvation. I've come to see through study over many years now that they're both wrong. That when Paul is talking about faith, he's talking about the faith of Jesus. It's not about anything we do. What we're doing, faith, hope, and love, are not things we do. They're not moral virtues. They're theological virtues. They're gifts. So that it's Jesus who gives his faith to us. So our Christian life is receiving and welcoming the faith that Jesus had in God and making it our own. We're not doing, we're receiving, welcoming, and embracing. Verse 4. When you meet those who disbelieve, strike at their necks. Then, when you overwhelm them, tighten the bonds. Then, free them graciously or hold them for ransom till they war lays down its burden. So, that's pretty self-explanatory. Verse 4. As for those who are slain in the way of God, he will not make their deeds go astray. He'll guide them and set their state aright and cause them to enter the garden, having made it known to them. My comment, I'm not sure of its value, is tragically, it's verses such as that one that are used to justify and encourage suicide bombers. If you're slain, blown up, in the way of God, in bringing about the Muslim faith, then you won't, your deeds will not go astray. God will guide you to the state of right and cause you to enter into the paradise. I'm not saying everyone interprets it that way, but the Salafi jihadists certainly do, and that's what people are led to believe to go into that dreadful situation. Verse 33, O you who believe, obey God and obey the messenger, and let not your deeds be in vain. Truly, those who disbelieve and turn from the way of God then die when they are disbelievers. God will not forgive them. And my comment from that is, throughout the Quran, and essential to Islam, is the teaching that people cannot obey God unless they obey Muhammad. More strictly, the Quran. Christians would use similar language in regard to Jesus. But the basis for the belief is different. In Islam, it's through Muhammad that God reveals God's will, and it's expressed in the Quran. In Christianity, Jesus in his person is God's self-revelation. To see Jesus is to see how God has chosen to reveal God's self in a human being. Our sacred literature, the New Testament, is an inspired response to Jesus. It's not itself God's revelation. And so can be, in fact, must be understood according to the rules of literary interpretation. The scriptures were born in a particular culture and must be understood in this context. I know I did that a few days ago with you, but what I want to say now is so important. I hope I can say it clearly. The difference between the Quran and the New Testament, an absolutely fundamental difference I've tried to describe in this diagram. Islam, the Muslim community, are those who accept to submit to the Quran, because the Quran is God's direct revelation, yes, through Muhammad, and only through Muhammad, by the way. The whole of the Quran comes, as they see it, directly from God and is spoken, recited at different occasions by the messenger, Muhammad. There's no other source for any of the material in the Quran but the revelation as recited by Muhammad. That's clear. Christianity is utterly different. It starts with Jesus. Person, who is in his person the revelation of God. The Christian community comes before the New Testament. Our faith is not based on the New Testament. It's based on Jesus and on the Christian community that followed him. So you've got this Christian community remembering Jesus, sharing their stories. It's hard to believe that Mary of Magdala, the apostle to the apostles, wouldn't have had some input into the memory, into the community, and people would have asked her. I think it's reasonable to surmise, but I'll only surmise it, that the rich young man who walked away sad, maybe a month later he came back, and maybe he told his story about how stupid he was to hang on to his possessions. This is all maybe, but things like this must have been going on in the early Christian community. And he tells a story of how he went to Jesus and what Jesus said to him and how stupid he was not to listen, but at last he's come back and then he tells his story. Mary, the mother of Jesus, we know from the Acts of the Apostles, gathering the disciples around her, waiting for the Pentecost gift. God help us, wouldn't Mary have had some input in the community? Wouldn't they have gone to her and talked to her, and she would have shared her faith and her memories and so on with, of course. And it goes on and on and on and on and on. There's years before Paul, who's independent of all this because he wasn't a disciple of Jesus, he was a disciple of the risen Christ, So his writing is only 15 years after the beginnings of it, after Jesus' death. But the first gospel, the Gospel of Peter, Gospel of Mark, is only 30 years, so only a generation. And why was it being written? It was being written because otherwise the memory could die. You don't need it written when people are assembling and coming together and remembering. Remember me whenever you come together, Jesus said, do this in memory of me. So they're all doing this remembering, but then obviously they're getting older and the memories could be lost. So Peter, according to tradition, gets Mark, who's good at this. He didn't start off too well, Mark. He went off with Paul and got frightened by the alligators, I think, and went back to Jerusalem to Mum. And when he was going to go on his second journey, Barnabas said, oh, good, let's take Mark with us. And Paul said, not on your life. I'm not here to change nappies. We got a mission to do. So he grabbed Titus and off they went and picked up Timothy and so on. So there was all this stuff going on in the early church. But there's 30 years of memories and the church is growing and building and involving people. According to the Acts, many priests, Jewish priests, joined the community, and no doubt many Pharisees did too. So this is an amazing thing happening before the New Testament emerges. So when we're reading the New Testament, heavens, we're reading Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, Paul, James, Jude, I don't have to go through them all, the John who's the author of the Apocalypse. It's a rich variety, and each one of them is drawing on 30 years of human memory and love and sharing and all of that. So that the New Testament is extraordinarily rich of memory and experience and prayer and contributions and so on. Which makes it, you can't parallel the New Testament and the Quran. I've tried to parallel them, but I hope I've made the point. They're very different, and our approach to them has to be very different. We read the New Testament to know the memories that pointed to Jesus. They only pointed to him. They didn't contain him. They didn't hold him. They didn't have him kind of locked in. But they pointed to this wonderful man in whom they saw God revealed in a human form. The Quran, looking at it humanly, I don't know how else to look at it, is all dependent on one person's psychic prayer, hopefully, sometimes anyhow, mystical experiences, sometimes anyhow, but it's all him, one person's experience. That doesn't make it negative, it just makes it very different. Surah 48. The occasion for this surah was a truce that permitted the Muslims to enter Mecca and go to the Kaaba. And this enabled the pilgrims to mix with the people of Mecca, and many joined the Muslim community. I got that, of course, from the study Bible and wherever else, I can't remember now, but that's what scholars suggest. Verse 8, truly we have sent thee as a witness and a bearer of glad tidings and as a warner that mankind may believe in God and his messenger and support him and honour him and that you may glorify him morning and evening. Verse 28, he it is who sent his messenger with guidance and the religion of truth to make it prevail over all religion. Surah 49. It's concerned with showing respect to Muhammad and how Muslims should treat each other as brothers. Verse 7, know that the messenger of God is among you. Were he to obey you in many matters, you would suffer. But God has caused you to love faith and has made it seem fair in your hearts. And he has caused you to despise disbelief, iniquity, and disobedience. Such are they who have been rightly guided. Verse 9. If two parties among the believers fall to fighting, make peace between them. If one of them aggresses against the other, fight those who aggress until they return to God's command. If they return, make peace between them with justice and act equitably. And my only little brief comment there is, I find that quite an enlightened policy when you look at what was going on in the tribal wars of 7th century Arabia. Verse 14. The Bedouins say, "We believe." Say, "You don't believe." Rather say, "We have submitted. For belief has not yet entered your hearts. Yet if you obey God and his messenger, he will not diminish for you aught of your deeds. Truly God is forgiving and merciful." It's the only text I found in the Quran that makes a distinction between submit and believe. It's obviously saying, no, tell them they're submitting. Yes, that's good. Submitting is really good. Believing in that text is at a deeper level. It's something a bit more profound than just submitting. I can't say much more of it. The study Quran makes this comment. This verse indicates that belief is of a higher rank than submission, that faith has degrees and that tribal affiliations are superseded by those of faith. Verse 15, only they are believers who believe in God and his messenger. Then do not doubt and strive, the word jihad is there, strive with their wealth and with their lives in the way of God. It is they who are truthful. They're willing to put their possessions and their lives on the line in the way of God, which is a common expression in the Quran, and often it's linked with the obligation to spread Islam. Surah 50. It sounds like I'm running through this more quickly. I am a bit, but actually the surahs are getting shorter as well. This is from Mecca, verse 28. Dispute not before me, since I have already presented unto you the threat. The commentary in the study Quran says, some read threat here as a reference to the Quran, since to warn people of the impending punishment is considered a function of all revelation and is a central theme in the Quran. Well, of course they said that because it's patently obviously so. In fact, it's going to become increasingly so as we move on today. This constant, I won't say unnecessary, I'm not there to judge that, but this constant threat of hell. Verse 39, bear patiently what they say and hymn the praise of your Lord before the rising of the sun and before the setting, and at night glorify him and after prostrations. This is ritual prayer, communal prayer, to which you're called by the cry, that's a later thing, but of the muezzin, crying out, calling to prayer. It's one of the five pillars of Islam. Monotheism, of course, is at the very basis. Then you have ritual prayer, care for the poor, the Hajj, and fasting in Ramadan. Surah 51 from Mecca tells the story, or refers to the story, of the heavenly guests who told Abram that he would have a son. It speaks of the destruction of Sodom and of Pharaoh's army in the sea. And I don't need to develop that because we've seen it 50 times, constantly referring to and obviously seen by the Muslims as realized in Muhammad, the seal of the prophets. Surah 52, verse 7. Truly, thy Lord's punishment shall come to pass. None can avert it. Surah 53, also from Mecca, verse 1 to 18, speak of Muhammad's visions, including the night journey that he made and his ascension into heaven. Surah 54 is from Mecca. Much of this surah focuses on divine warnings of punishment. The word warnings occurs 11 times in this one fairly brief surah. Verse 17, in truth, we have made the Quran easy to remember. So is there any who remember? Well, there were some who remembered, and that's when Uthman, some 20 years or so, 15, 20 years later, called the seven best memorizers to come together and see what they agreed on, and that became the Quran. Surah 55 speaks of the compassionate Rahman. It's a hymn of praise of the Creator who transcends God's wonderful creation. Among the pleasures in store for believers, we've done this earlier, but I'll just put it in context here in Surah 55. Among the pleasures are, and it's all from the male point of view, of course, maidens of modest gaze, whom neither man nor jinn has ever touched, good and beautiful ones, maidens secluded in pavilions, untouched as yet by man or jinn, they recline upon green cushions and beautiful wonders. All those verses are in Surah 55, and we've looked at it. Surah 56. It's concerned with judgment. It describes the condition of the foremost in the Garden of Delight on the Day of Judgment. In verse 17 to 22, among the joys of paradise, quote, and this is the only one I know that's like this, it talks about male, young males. Immortal youths wait upon them with goblets, ewers, and a cup from a flowing spring, with fruits as they choose, and the meat of birds as they desire, and wide-eyed, black-eyed maidens, the likeness of concealed pearls. I don't make anything of that, but all of it's common except this immortal youths serving them in paradise. On the right hand are virgins, amorous peers, and on the left, scorching wind and boiling liquid, and the shadow of black smoke. So for heaven's sake, make your choice and make it sensibly. Join us. Surah 57, verse 16. Has not the time come for those who believe for their hearts to be humbled to the remembrance of God, and the truth has come down, and to be not like those who were given the book aforetime, but the span of time was too long for them, such that their hearts hardened, and many of them are iniquitous. Plenty of statements in the Hebrew scriptures about that. The rebellious people on their way through the desert and all that. You're quite familiar with it. And the prophets are often talking like that. And he's saying, same with Christians, they've lost the plot, as it were. They've lost what Jesus revealed, and we've got to bring them back to Jesus as fulfilled in Muhammad. Surah 57, verse 16. Has not the time come for those who believe for their hearts to be humbled to the remembrance of God, and the truth has come down, and to be like those who were given the be not like those who were given the book aforetime. But the span of time was too long for them. I'm sorry, I've read that already. Their hearts hardened, and many of them are iniquitous. Verse 20, in the hereafter there shall be severe punishment, forgiveness from God and contentment, and the life of the world is naught but the enjoyment of delusion. The study Quran quotes this Ibn Achiba, one of the historical commentators on the Quran, and he writes, the world is something that appears beautiful on the outside, but that conceals what is ugly within it, like one who tricks people and then cheats them. The world appears to those who pursue it as sweetness and infatuation, overtaking them little by little, until they become totally entangled in it and neglect all preparation for the hereafter. Life passes from their hand in vanity, and the world continues to delude and betray them until it brings them bankrupt to the moment of their death. The world can have negative connotations in the Christian scriptures. Jesus says, John chapter 7, the world hates me because I testify against it that its works are evil. In John's gospel, where that occurs, when he uses that meaning, the world is considered evil, insofar as it's not open to the Spirit. But fundamentally, the Christian attitude to the world is different. Our mission is to penetrate to the heart of the world, to recognize the heart as sacred, to actually bring purification to the world, not to escape it, though throughout Christian spiritual writing, probably influenced by the Black Plague and a whole lot of other things, there's quite a lot of negative stuff about the world. My elder sister Maria joined at the age of 30-something, the Blessed Sacrament Sisters. And I don't know why I remember. She died very young, at 48. But I just remember this thing she told me. She said she got a shock when she went to the convent and they were all talking about leaving the world. She was thinking, sounds a bit creepy to say the least, but she didn't think she was leaving the world. But there was a fair bit of spirituality. Imitation of Christ. Every time I go into the world, I return less a man. What bully for him? Jesus went into the world. May I read from Jesus again? God so loved the world that he gave his only Son, so that everyone who believes in him may not perish but may have eternal life. God did not send the Son into the world to condemn the world, but in order that the world might be saved through him. To the woman, I do not condemn you. Sin no more. Jesus, God in Jesus, is revealing God as love. And love is the converting any situation. If we don't bring love to it, well, you're getting in the road, we should keep out. If we bring love, it may or may not succeed. Jesus' crucifixion didn't seem to succeed at the time. It may not succeed, but there's nothing else to do but to love the world. Surah 57 still and verse 16. We sent Noah and Abraham and established prophethood and the book among their progeny. And among them is he who is rightly guided, yet many of them are iniquitous. Then we sent our messenger to follow in their footsteps. We sent Jesus, the son of Mary, and we gave him the gospel. And placed kindness and mercy in the hearts of those who follow him. And monasticism they invented. We didn't ordain it for them, only to seek God's contentment. Yet they did not observe it with proper observance. So we gave those of them who believed their reward, but many of them are iniquitous. So God is revealing to Muhammad that monasticism has nothing to do with God. It's an aberration that they brought in. However, if I may read to you again Surah 5 verse 82 from Mecca, we read, "Thou wilt surely find the nearest in affection towards those who believe to be those who say we're Christians. That is because among them are priests and monks, and because they are not arrogant." There's been a shift in Muhammad's opinion of Christians. Or God has taken away one thing he said earlier and now replaced it with another. Surah 58. A revelation in response to a woman who complained to Muhammad that her husband had been sent away for no good reason. Surah 59. This surah refers to the Banu Nadir, a Jewish tribe of Medina, who were exiled for having broken their treaty, but they had their property confiscated. So that's another source of wealth for the nascent Muslim community. Verse 6, God grants his messengers authority over whomsoever he will, and God is powerful over all things, asserting the authority that Muhammad has given him by God. Surah 60 from Medina, verse 1. O you who believe, do not take mine enemy and your enemy as awliya, friend, protector, governor, all understandable at the time. But that text can be quoted by those today who say that Muslims should not live under any law but Sharia. And it is used in that way. Verse 7. It may be that God will forge affection between you and those of them with whom you are in enmity. God is powerful. God is forgiving, merciful. God does not forbid you with regard to those who did not fight you on account of religion and did not expel you from their homes, from treating them righteously and being just towards them. Truly, God loves the just. God only forbids you with those who fought you on account of religion and expelled you from their homes and supported your expulsion. God forbids you from befriending them. Whoever befriends them, they are wrongdoers. And I'm suggesting that in 7th century Arabia, it presents a pretty enlightened view. It does, however, fall short of Jesus' teaching. One, that God doesn't have enemies. And two, to love our enemies. Surah 61, and the scholars are divided as to where it comes from, hence the question mark there. Verse 6 reads, "When Jesus, son of Mary, said, O children of Israel, truly I am the messenger of God unto you, confirming that which came before me in the Torah, and bearing glad tidings of a messenger to come after me." Jesus is saying this in the Quran, whose name is Ahmad. Ahmad, another form of Muhammad, so that enabled the Quran to see Jesus when he's actually talking about the coming of the Spirit. They say he was actually talking about the coming of Muhammad. Well, he wasn't, and that is not in the New Testament anything to do with Ahmad. Verse 9, God sent his messenger with guidance and the religion of truth to make it prevail over all religion. Verse 14, O you who believe, be helpers of God, just as Jesus, son of Mary, said to the apostles, Who are my helpers to God? And the apostles replied, We are helpers to God. Then a group from the children of Israel believed, and a group disbelieved. The Jews should have all become Christians if they were listening to the revelation of God coming down to Jesus. And the Christians should all become Muslims for the same logic. Surah 62. It has only 11 verses, and most of the following surahs, it's not absolutely exact, because sometimes the verses are two words, sometimes the verses are a line. So they're all shorter than this. And as I say, consequently, there's less to present and less to comment on, which you mightn't mind. Surah 62, verse 9 reads, O you who believe, when you're called to the congregational prayer, hasten to the remembrance of God and leave off trade. That is better for you, if you but knew. And when prayer is completed, disperse through the land and seek the bounty of God and remember God much, that happily you may prosper. A lovely statement inviting them to one of the pillars of Islam, ritual, common, community prayer. Verse 6, it's the same for them whether thou askest forgiveness for them or thou askest forgiveness for them not. God will never forgive them. Truly, God does not guide iniquitous people. I surely don't have to make explicit how different the Christian message is from that. That was Surah 63. Verse 9, O you who believe, let neither your property nor your children divert you from the remembrance of God. Which made me think of Jesus' words, strive first for the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all the other things will be given to you. Surah 64, verse 10. Those who disbelieve and deny our signs, they are inhabitants of the fire, abiding therein. What an evil journey's end. Surah 65, verse 1 to 2. When you divorce your wives, divorce them for the waiting period. And that's interpreted as 3 months. And count well the waiting period and reverence your Lord. Expel women not from their houses, nor shall they depart unless they commit a flagrant indecency. These are the limits set by God. When they have fulfilled their term, take them back in an honourable way or separate from them in an honourable way. And call 2 just persons among yourselves to witness and uphold the testimony for God. Very similar to Jewish teaching. In the Arab culture, as in many cultures, only the male had the power to divorce. Jesus spoke out against this practice in Judaism in his day. He talked about being unfaithful to her, to God, to her. Paul deals with the issue of divorce in his first letter to the Christian community of Corinth, chapter 7. He acknowledges that there's a place for divorce in certain circumstances, and he stresses the importance of peace between husband and wife, and also the importance of being free to follow one's faith. This is not the place for me to go into an analysis of 1 Corinthians chapter 7. I've done it in my commentary over about half a dozen, at least, pages, as best I can, so I couldn't do it carelessly now. But he does see the need for separation when peace and faith are impossible in a relationship. Verse 7 of Surah 65. God tasks us, tasks no soul beyond that which he has given it. God will bring ease after hardship. Quite lovely. And Paul has a similar statement. God is faithful. He won't let you be tested beyond your strength. But with the testing, he will also provide the way out so that you may be able to endure it. Surah 66, verse 1 to 2. O prophet, why dost thou forbid that which God has made lawful unto thee, seeking the good pleasure of your wives? And God is forgiving and merciful. God has already ordained for you the absolution of your oaths, and God is your master. He is the knower, the wise. I find that one of the absolutely most problematic, and it's in the Quran, no one denies it, and it's all explained. I've did it with you already, but may I do it quickly again. One night, when Hafsah, one of his wives, it was her turn to be with him, instead of that, he took a Coptic Christian slave girl in and spent the night with her. Hafsa was very angry about it and threatened to tell his main wife, Aisha, I think it was, of what happened. And he said, look, don't, you mustn't tell her. And he took an oath that he never again have intercourse with this Coptic slave girl, Maria, or Miriam. And then that night he has a vision from God who tells him it's okay. You can forgive me for thinking this is good, psychologically problematic. So at any case, that's what God says. The Quran says, I absolve you from your oath, you don't have to keep it, everything's fine. I can't help thinking, it doesn't make it any value, but I can't help thinking that something happened when Khadija died after their years of together. She must have been a very strong support for Muhammad in his difficult psychic journey, mystical and whatever else. But when she died, a lot happened. In verse 12, it presents Mary as an example to Muhammad's wives. Mary, the daughter of Imran, and we've seen that already, that's the name they give her father, preserved her chastity. Then we breathed therein of our spirit, and she confirmed the word of her Lord and his books, and was among the devoutly obedient. A recognition of the value of Mary in the life of Jesus and in the Christian life. So he's asking his wives to be chaste like Mary. I wonder what went on when he held a mirror to his own face. I don't know. It's a different world, a different understanding male and female relationships, clearly. Surah 67 reads, oh, this section highlights one of Muhammad's central convictions. He's sent to warn people, and if they don't heed the warning, hell awaits them. Verse 68, or Surah 68, those who refuse belief consider Muhammad to be possessed. That was what they were accusing him of. Whereas he is naught else than a reminder for the world. And I conclude this with 69. This is yet another surah on the final judgment. Either enjoying a contented life in a lofty garden and low-hanging clusters. May I remind you, it's never talking about communion with God. God is above communion. God is the transcendent one. The best the Quran can do to describe paradise is to describe paradise, a walled garden with fruit and maidens and grapes and pearls, and which God gives, and that's a beautiful gift that God gives them. But Jesus, his intimate communion with God, his spirit that he shares with us, takes Christians into an almost unbelievable sharing in his intimacy with God. And heaven is seen as communion with God. I conclude with a piece of music, Seek the Lord.